If you just went to your boss and you're like, let's put an ad in Psychology Today, like that's obviously the most obvious application of that not obvious insight, but they'd be like, why would we do that? We're not a psychology product. But like, you now know something that other people don't know, which is that RICP doesn't just read HR Manager Today, they read Psychology Today, right?
That'd be so... a super interesting publication though.
Here's what go-to-market teams are missing. Proof. That's what I think of every morning when I fire up LinkedIn and scroll through boring manifestos and endless lukewarm takes. Opinions are cheap and proof is gold. I'm Mark Huber and this is The Proof Point, a show from User Evidence that helps go-to-market teams find ideas, get frameworks, and swap tactics. Each episode includes an unfiltered discussion with the biggest names in B2B SaaS to help find the proof points that I'm in search of. You'll learn from sales, marketing, and customer success leaders in the trenches, where I ask them, seriously, what actually works for you? One of our guests actually told me this felt like we were having drinks at a bar and talking about work without all the BS. And that pretty much sums it up and why I'm so excited for this new show. Join us every other week for new episodes. Hot takes, always welcome. On today's episode of The Proof Point, we're getting real about research. Audience research, customer research, market research, all things research. And we've got three names who know a lot about this space. First up, Amanda Natividad. She's the VP of Marketing at SparkToro, an absolute riot, a great human, and one of my favorite follows on social media. Next up, we have MJ Smith. MJ has quickly risen the ranks to becoming the CMO at Colab, and she is super passionate about this topic. Trust me, I did a lot of research on LinkedIn, and she has been posting about this for a while. And last, but definitely not least, my boss, the CEO of User Evidence, Evan Huck. Evan has worked in the survey and research space for a while now, so he's seen and learned quite a bit. And then one little wrinkle for this, we cut the recording a little too early because one of the guests on today's episode admitted to being painfully hungover while we recorded. So if you listen, DM me on LinkedIn and let me know who you think was hungover when we recorded, and I may or may not have a gift for you. Just kidding. I'll send something. Enjoy. So, MJ, I actually did a lot of homework on this, if you saw all the LinkedIn notifications of me looking at your old posts, and you seem to be pretty passionate about this, so why don't you kick us off here?
Yeah, well, first of all, Devin Reed is a very hard act to follow, so I'm secretly hoping that you drop another episode in between that one and this one. But yes, my prompt for Mark was go scorched earth on something. So I will tell you about a take that is super popular on LinkedIn that I just kind of rolled my eyes at like 80% of the time, which is this take that like B2B is not creative enough. And I don't roll my eyes at it because B2B is super creative, but I just think it's like a complaint most of the time. It's like a complaint with no like substance, right? It's just somebody being like, oh, well, I'm a creative super genius, but like my boss always shoots down, you know, my ideas and it's not my fault, right? And I'm kind of like, okay, cool. B2B is not creative, but like, what should I be doing, right? Either as your boss or like as an individual contributor whose ideas keep getting shot down, like what can I actually do to get creative ideas approved inside of a company, right? And like when I was in individual contributor roles, I got crazy ideas approved and I got crazy ideas shot down a lot. So my version of this, of like, what can you actually do is show your boss that there's some customer insight behind your crazy idea. Because honestly, like if you're bringing a crazy idea that just like you made up from scratch with no evidence of like why it resonates with the customer or why there's an insight that you understand that your competitors don't understand. So they're all not doing this crazy thing, but like, you could do it and you could stand out and it would actually work. If you can't back it up with any evidence, then I think your boss is probably right to shoot down that idea.
So here was my idea that I actually pitched to Mark in a reverse boss fashion. I have no evidence to back up that this was a good idea. In fact, had we surveyed anyone, we probably would have found it was a terrible idea. But I'm a big house music, like electro house DJ. And my idea for good, creative, non-boring content was to just DJ house music on a Friday and just have cool marketers stop by and chat marketing. But Mark said that was too out there. But
well,
I do think...
Let me defend myself a little bit. I don't think I actually said no. I just said I have this podcast called The Proof Point that I got to get going here. So it wasn't a hard no. We might have to come back to that idea.
That's fair. Maybe after this we can explore that. But I do think it's like, it's a cultural thing, MJ, right? Like creating a culture in the company which starts from the top down that celebrates risk taking and encourages, you know, a little bit of boldness and fun. And it depends on your audience, of course, as well. Yeah, you know, we're selling to marketers. I remember the job description that we put out for our director of product marketing, one of the first lines was, marketing's charter here is to be bold, opinionated, and have fun. And then, of course, all the stuff they're supposed to do. But I think you have to have that safe space for creative risk taking. And that's, you know, what often gets stifled, you know, especially as a company grows.
So, Amanda, how did we get to this point? Because why this happens, and MJ posted about this on LinkedIn, is go-to-market teams and marketing teams kind of just skip over the research process. They either don't do it or they just speed right through it. So how do we get to this point?
How did people get to the point of not doing research?
Yeah, I feel stupid asking this. It's like such a novel, elementary concept of like this stuff works, but so many people don't do it.
I feel like when people don't do it, it's because they've already learned from whatever institutional knowledge they have at the company. Like, oh, I did that in my onboarding or in the training, or like my boss told me this is what it is, this is how it is, or this is what we know about the customer. And I think the other problem is that there's a problem when people think that research, whether it's audience research, customer research, is sort of a one and done kind of job, right? Like, oh, we did it, we're done now. But I mean, it's not something you have to do constantly, right? It doesn't have to be like every week you have a new research thing you do, but it's something that people should be doing a little bit more frequently, right? Maybe it's like once a quarter, couple times a year or something, where you're making sure if what you knew before holds true, if there have been any changes. And when I say this, I mean like kind of digging deeper, right? Like you might know that the top line motivations probably don't change, right? Like we know that our customers have the same pain point, right? But same overall pain point, but there might be some new pain points that emerge, or your customers or audience might be influenced by a new podcast or another YouTube channel that has sprung up over the past couple months. And those are the things that are really important for people to keep up with. The other part, this is kind of related to this, is sort of trend chasing, right? So I feel like what we see a lot is...
Wait, people trend chasing marketers? Yeah. Like, who would do that?
Well, like people like not
no,
doing
every,
research.
No, I'm saying everyone does that.
right. No, exactly, right? Where it's like we see people not really doing enough research or marketers not doing enough research, but they're doing trend chasing, right? They're chasing after trends, seeing like what's the next meme we should glom onto, where like maybe it's fun to do and it's good to have a pulse on things, sure, but, you know, those are... Trends are just fleeting. They don't really move the needle on things. Not usually. Sometimes they can't. And we could talk about that later if you want to.
Why do you think I got this fun Western jacket, right? Yeah. I'm from San Diego. I'm a surfer. I came to Jackson Hole. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a cowboy.
It's timeless, right? It's timeless. It can be, depending on your view of things. But yeah.
So, Amanda, why don't you kick us off here on this? Because you actually mentioned something that was in the outline, so thank you for reading it. This notion of audience research versus customer research. So how do you think about those two?
So I don't know that marketers think about audience research, right? I feel like it's not really something that we know in a codified way or in a broad way, right? Like everybody knows... in a sense, what customer research is. You know, not everybody knows how to do it, sure, but you say customer research, any marketer knows generally what that means. But I feel like we're still at this early point in audience research where not everyone knows what it means, or they think they know what it means. And it really is researching your audience, and your audience is inclusive of people who may or may not be your customers. And when they're not your customers, they could still be an influential factor, right? So your audience isn't just your customers, although they are a subset of it. Your audience would include your peers, competitors, or people who could be your sort of co-marketer, right? People who would share your audience but are not a competing product. Other people in your audience would include press, analysts, employees at your company, right? So this is a more holistic way to look at who could influence the buying decisions of your customers.
Can you give me some examples? Like, is that like winter when we're talking about like message testing? Are we talking about like sourcing panels and asking them questions and surveys? I guess like what constitutes audience research, or how do we do it well?
I think that's part of it, right? You could do this through interviews, through surveys. You could also do it just by like creating, we'll say, I'll talk through the manual ways of doing this first, right? Like you could follow the social accounts that are influential in your given niche or industry, consume that content, right, and get a sense of what's top of mind for your audience, right? So audience research is essentially doing what you can to understand what's influential to your audience, to find ways to understand what's top of mind for them in general, what they're influenced by, which I think I already said, and stuff like that. So you could also listen to the podcasts they're listening to, right? Watch the YouTube channels that they're watching. And at SparkToro, what we offer is a solution that helps you do all of this really quickly and at scale. You can search for your audiences based on like how they might choose to self-describe publicly. So you could search for people who self-describe as, you know, CEO or product manager. And then you could also search by website. So you could search for more information on people who visit a certain popular website or a certain popular niche website. And when you do that, you'll also learn who else they follow, the other websites they frequent, their demographic information, the subreddits that they are in.
Yeah, that makes sense. MJ, what does that look like?
For being in the Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce subreddit, so I don't know if I want SparkToro returning that on me.
I've got a Reddit story that I think will pick up that thread around risk-taking that Evan and I kind of were digging into at the beginning of the episode, which is, I think you're right, Evan, that you should have some room for creative risk-taking. I think one of the ways Kyle Lacy frames it up is like, you should be able to hit all your targets with 80% of the budget so that you can just like try stuff with the remaining 20%. Yeah. That way of thinking about it resonates with me. But I also think like companies can do risk-taking or like create things that they think of as creative, like just for the sake of like it being creative and off the wall, and it can backfire massively. And how does this tie back into Reddit? My product marketing manager sent me this Reddit thread like months ago, and it's still like seared in my brain. And I won't name the name of the company that like made this marketing material, but the Reddit thread was a rant from somebody who's in Colab's ICP. This marketing team at this company released this coloring book, right, that was like supposed to describe all these different things about their product. And they're like, I don't understand anything about what this product does. Like, why don't you just give me some useful information, right? And the language was very colorful. I think it contained, at one point, like, what the googly moogly fuck is this? Is like a direct... And that's right. And so I think like you have to be able to do the basics of like blocking and tackling and being clear and understanding what your customer cares about before you like can really spend energy on being creative. And I think a lot of marketing teams need to build the muscle of like do research, publish good messaging, and then think about creativity. So that's why I push back when people just complain about the lack of creativity. It's like, in some sense, you got to earn the right, you know?
Yeah, that's true. And points to whoever that was for trying and thinking outside the box with a coloring book. I do think it's interesting, though, like, you know, when you think about audience research or customer research informing what you're doing, I do see a tendency to sometimes over-index on research or have a more analysis-first mode of acting. I think, you know, in this recent product marketing that we hired, yeah, I interviewed a few folks that were like, well, you know, my first 3 months would be, you know, research, we're doing surveys, we're talking to customers, which, you know, all sounded good. But then you look at it, you're like, all right, wait, so we have 3 months until we start doing anything. And after 3 months, we come back with a deck that's like, here's what I think's going on. So there's a mix of, you know, I think especially as it relates to creativity, you know, if you're guided entirely by your research and what people tell you is what they want, you miss out on this more intuitive, you know, bold position where you can lead people on what they don't even know they want yet. So, you know, I think there's a healthy balance, especially in a startup, with speed and research, but also intuition and going outside the box and kind of bucking the trend in terms of where the data might be saying to go, if that makes sense.
I have been talking a lot on LinkedIn lately about strategic narrative. And our strategic narrative is like not entirely fueled by research. I mean, it's fueled by validated insights, but I constantly get people in the comments like, oh, like strategic narrative, like, well, why don't you just talk to your customers and ask them what they want and do messaging around that? And I do a lot of talking to customers and figuring out what they want and doing messaging around that. But I actually think at the highest level, strategic narrative is like what your brand stands for. Like, I think your brand should stand for something that you think is true, not necessarily something that your customers tell you. So our approach to strategic narrative wasn't actually based in what I typically prescribe as like customer research best practice, but rather like our CEO says things over and over again that really resonate with customers on calls. And like in that way, those things are being validated. And then you go back and you stitch it together like into a story format that really makes sense and is easier for other people to deliver. But that's not what I would describe as customer research. So like even I'm like the biggest customer research evangelist. Like there are parts of your messaging where like you actually shouldn't drive it completely off of customer research, especially if you're like a startup that's creating a category.
Yeah.
What's a strategic narrative?
For us, it's like the story of what the brand stands for. We used Andy Raskin's framework. So it's like five different pieces, but it starts with this idea of name the shift that's happening in the world. And so we figured out like the fundamental shift that we believe is happening in the world of mechanical engineering. And we're telling a story about how solving for this shift in the particular ways that we solve for it is going to help our customers like drive the highest level business outcomes that they want to drive, which at the end of the day tends to be boring things like save money, make money, execute the strategy. But, you know, as we all know, if you just say buy our product to save money, like you're going to get lost in a sea of people.
I feel like I've seen that a lot. Like there was this trend in the last 4 years to like, we got to talk about business impacts, but then you, for any software, if you distill it down, it's like, oh, well, we save you time and money and deliver ROI quickly. So you have 10,000 tools that are like, ROI, time savings, money, no idea what the hell they do. But I appreciate that at least some folks have, you know, gone back towards, okay, I'm going to at least give you like a little bit on like what's going on, the space I'm playing in and what we do, rather than just everything being ROI focused.
I went and saw Andy Raskin talk at that Pavilion event in October in Nashville. And he gave this story that I think just illustrates it perfectly. And he said, if you were going to try to sell something to Cinderella, would you say that your product helps her get to the ball, marry royalty, or live happily ever after? And he like asked the audience, so people would raise their hands. And a couple people raised their hand for get to the ball, a couple people raised their hand for marry royalty, then everybody else raises their hand for happily ever after, right? And so then he goes back to one of the people, he's like, okay, somebody who didn't say happily ever after, why did you not say that? And the person was like, well, everybody else said that, right? So what he, like his point was like, actually, in a lot of ways, the brands that get more specific, even if they're not talking about the big happily ever after outcome, are the ones that are able to stand out from the pack. So he like pushes a lot of his clients to be like more that. Specific. And Colab, we tried to be really specific about a change that wasn't just like, you know, a change that any company in our space could be talking about.
Side Andy Raskin comment here, and I think the world of him, he's the man. Have you seen what he does with his mom and his podcast?
Yeah.
Evan and Amanda, have you seen this?
No.
So Andy's, I don't know how old Andy is. Andy's probably, what, maybe like 40s, 50s, somewhere in that range, probably 50s. He has his mom come and record the intros for the podcast. It'd be like my mom saying, oh, I'm going to have Evan, Amanda, and MJ on this podcast. She'd have like no idea, but it comes across as so heartfelt and so human. It's amazing. I love it.
I did appreciate your mom's screenshot saying, congratulations, Mark, on a great
job. Yeah. I'll have to link out to that from the show notes. But so basically what happened was my girlfriend Courtney's my, I would say, little hype woman at times whenever I'm doing marketing things. So she sent my family thread a text of, you know, hey, the podcast is live, yada, yada, yada. And my mom sent me a picture of little Mark, probably at, I would guess, like 3 years old. I'll show you the picture afterwards, of me holding some little microphone with my little blonde bowl cut. It was pretty awesome. So I posted it on the UE Slack channel yesterday after we launched everything.
That's sweet. Wait, does your fiance listen to the show too?
She does. She admits that she has no idea what I'm talking about, which maybe is feedback that I need to like change up how I'm talking about things or get better at what I'm doing. But she says it's fun to listen to. She just doesn't really know what
it's about. ROI. That's what
yeah.
It's about.
So funny. My husband never listens. It's so funny. He never looks at my social media content, like none of it. Even though like we're on the same social media channels, I'm like, did you see my post? It went a little viral. He's like, no. I'm like, oh, like, or I'll say like, I think you saw it, but you didn't like it. He's like, yeah, because that's not for me. Like, I don't care. I'm like, oh, you could hit the like button.
One time.
He's like, no, it's not for me. I'm not your target audience.
Oh, that's amazing. So before I get into the next section, one of the things I want to talk through is just the cost or kind of impact of not doing customer research. So maybe MJ, since you're like super passionate about this, what do you see like the big negative costs and impacts of not doing enough customer research?
Yeah, I think back to the idea of creativity, you have to rely on assumptions if you don't do any research. And most of the time, assumptions are boring, right? So I think the reason that most B2B marketing is boring is because we're building messaging and campaigns around boring assumptions, right? The VP of finance only wants to cut costs, or like the production manager, you know, wants to, you know, increase uptime or, you know, efficiency or something like that. Also, though, you can just like completely waste your marketing dollars by marketing to the wrong person or saying the wrong thing. And I think a great example of this is when I was at Firetrace, we tried to go into a new segment called airport ground support equipment. And so this is like all of the equipment that like tows the airplanes and puts the baggage on and you know, refuels them when you land at the airport. And it was like a fire suppression, like we put out fires on, you know, engines and stuff. So we wanted to be able to sell into these vehicles that are like next to the planes, right? And we were like, okay, well, who's the ICP for that? And we did this exercise that I talked about before where it's like, build your hypothesis. And we're like, okay, who cares the most about this? We're like, probably the VP of operations at the airport. And that like makes sense if you think, I guess, right? If you don't know. And so then we were like, okay, let's go find out. And we found out that actually the airlines own all this equipment, right? So the person who cares about that the most is not employed by the airport. They're employed by the airline, and their title's like fleet manager, right? If we had done no research, we would have gone out and probably run a bunch of ads to like VP of operations at an airport who frankly only cares about like how, if their McDonald's is going to renew their space or whatever, right? So I think that's the risk. It's like, are you just assuming that you know who the customer even is in some cases? And I think a lot of businesses like don't realize how little that they really actually know, because it's easy to like talk about these things in the abstract. And so I always encourage people, like, if you think you know something, force yourself to write it down. And if everybody writes it down and it's all the same, everybody says the same thing, then yeah, you probably know your ICP and your value prop. But if nobody can actually write it down in any kind of level of detail, or everyone's saying different things, like, you might need to do some research to validate what's true and not true.
I'm just thinking of all the times where if I would have had everyone write down what our ICP is together and how many different answers I would have gotten every single time. It's just wild.
It's like that game of telephone, right? From back in grade school. You get down to SDR level, you're like, ooh, wow, that's interesting.
Do you have any like horror stories from your SurveyMonkey days of just customers who skipped over big research steps and made very poor decisions?
Well, I think like one of the interesting challenges with customer research, you know, the kind of lens that we're talking about it right now is more like earlier stage market research to define messaging and positioning to inform internal decisions. How do we message this? What should we build? But there's so many other functions in the company that need to access the voice of the customer and get feedback from the customer. And one of the big problems that I see is that some function, either it could be customer research, it could be customer success, ends up just hoarding access to that customer base. They're like, oh, well, you know, no one else can touch our customers because, you know, we're the ones that are doing the research and we own the relationships. You know, the concern is legitimate. It's like, we don't want to, you know, in the SurveyMonkey world is we don't want to over survey our customers, right? You know, they just got an NPS survey. We did this customer research. We did this product research. But if I think about the vendors that I work with, it's like, rarely am I sitting there, man, that, you know, Gong for the fifth time sent me a survey. This is unbelievable. Like, I have my own life to live. I'm not paying attention to that. And I think the error that's way more common is no one talks to me at all. Maybe it's because I'm CEO and I'm not in the right persona bucket or something like that. But the vast majority of vendors that we have never talk to us at all. So back to the problem, it's like, there's this scarce resource, which is customer feedback, that gets hoarded, and it needs to be democratized across functions. Marketing would love to talk to customers to understand messaging, positioning, but also, you know, get advocates that can do testimonials and case studies. Product would like to talk to them to, you know, get insights on how to improve the customer experience. And I see a lot of like a good natured hesitance towards letting different people in the company approach the customer at all with any sort of, you know, research or feedback ask. I don't know if, you know, MJ, Amanda, if you've experienced that sort of scarcity pull or balance in the customer with different people trying to reach out to folks.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes too, like when, you know, when we'll say marketers, when marketers don't talk to customers, probably in larger organizations, I think the big issue is for political reasons. Like, they don't know that they're allowed to. Totally. Or they don't feel like they're allowed to. They don't feel empowered to. They're worried that if they do it, they'll get in trouble by the other team that's like, no, we're the ones who lead these customer research interviews. Like, I say this as someone who's worked at a very political company where, you know, the internal politics in a company that was like, that was very, it was hard to do anything because you would always piss off another department. So it sort of became like, well, we have to just wait for the product team to do the interviews. They're doing them next month. So when we find out, and then they have to collate the insights. So in 2 months, we'll know what the customer wants. When it's like, I get it. It's hard because like in some of these organizations, you will get in trouble for stepping on someone else's toes talking to a customer. But I do think there's a way you can kind of get around it as a marketer, and it's to do a case study because you have to talk to a customer. And then no one's going to get mad at you for doing that. So I would just say, like, volunteer yourself to do a case study. If you're a marketer at a team where you feel like you're not really allowed or empowered to talk to customers, ask if you can do a case study. And then usually the customer success team or a salesperson is happy to be like, oh, this one customer loves us. You should talk to them.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was a prospect a couple weeks ago that had a similar scenario where they wanted to go do case studies, but they had just done an NPS survey, like, I don't know, 4 months ago or something. Like, I mean, if you spend a bunch of money with a vendor, that'd be equivalent of like me going to my wife and being like, hey, honey, like, how's our relationship doing? And she'd be like, not good. All right, well, like 4 or 5, like 3. Oh, okay, cool. All right, well, here's your $5 Starbucks gift card and we'll see you next year. It's like for these high level relationships, it makes sense that you're going to want to know how you're doing. And I think the reason why there has to be multiple touches is because different functions want to know different things. Like in your example, Amanda, with, all right, the product team 2 months from now is going to go give us a bunch of insights and hopefully they'll be rest. They're going to ask stuff like, you know, please rate these features on a scale of 1 to 5. And we're going to know that, you know, this feature is a 3.5, which tells us nothing as a marketer for what we want to know, which is like, why did you buy us and what problem are you solving and what kind of benefits and results that you've seen? So I think it's okay to allow different functions to approach the customer directly for different purposes. Ideally, that data doesn't just sit in a silo. And I do think that's a problem. It's like, you know, if you do that product management survey and identify a happy customer, they're like, oh, cool, people like the product, but that never gets to marketing and vice versa. Like as a marketer, we do an outreach. Hey, can you do a DT review? We hit someone negative and we're like, oh, okay, well, that didn't fit the purpose and it's discarded. So I think, you know, democratizing access to the customer base allows each function to be informed by the voice of the customer, which is, I think, what companies always say they want, but there's friction in the way of getting to that goal.
I think the scarcity thing is real, though, Evan, to your point from earlier. Like, do you think a lot of companies, like their top 10 customers or 10% of customers or whatever, are the ones that they're constantly asking for everything, right? They're asking them for product feedback. They're asking them to do the case study. They're asking them if they want to talk to marketing. And then, meanwhile, like, there's a bunch of people in your customer base that never get asked anything, right? And, like, I think there's just more friction in getting to those people. Like, maybe you don't have their phone number or whatever, right? I one time just was, like, digging through CRM at one of the manufacturing companies, and I wrote, like, cold emails to a bunch of people that I just found their information in CRM. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, like, hey, I'm looking to talk to some customers. One of them called me back, got my number out of my email signature, called me back. I was pissed and like ranted about like the service that they got for like 60 minutes. And then at the end of it, he was just like, it's great to actually have someone from your company listen to me, right? And I was actually like super energized by it, right? Because I was like, great, here's a bunch of stuff that I just learned that we didn't know that I can go and fix. So yeah, like there are probably some people that like would like to be heard from. It's just that they're not in that top 10% super accessible. So it's like, stop bothering the 10% of people that you always bother, right? Like do a little more work and sometimes the gold mine. And by the way, there's even people out that aren't your customers, right? Like just go find like non-customer ICP fits, like cold message them on LinkedIn, right? Like our product marketing manager used to be an SDR and he does this all the time. So, I mean, he's flexing those old SDR muscles, but like you get so many insights that you would just never get. Nobody cares if you cold DM a random person on LinkedIn, right? Like they're not one of the precious customers that you need to, you know, protect their time and not ask them too many favors.
Yeah,
I love that. We at Metadata, there was a short list of like probably 5 or 6 people that I can think of off the top of my head that were customers that we would go to so often for every sort of internal request, feedback request. We had to buy them like fairly expensive gifts. as a thank you, because it's like, we are using and abusing this so like frequently right now that we felt bad. But no, I mean,
thank goodness for those people, right? Like, yeah. Love them, right? But there are other people, right? You don't need to always be tapping into that scarce resource.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about what's kind of, you know, broken about the research process and why it's so important. But what I'm most excited to do is kind of give away a few cheat codes of how you all are doing research, you know, in your day-to-day and on your team. So maybe Amanda, kick us off. What are some of your cheat codes for doing research?
Well, I feel like I have an unfair advantage in that I market to other marketers. I talk to marketers all day, and that's already the cheat code. Like, I already talked to my customer base, right? So there's that. Other cheat codes, I think that's interesting. You know, one thing I think is really important, this goes back to audience research, is so a long time ago when I started marketing to people in HR, like HR and people in the HR and benefits space, the unlock for me was learning from our PR firm that HR managers read Psychology Today. Like, I thought that was super interesting.
I would have never guessed that.
Right. You wouldn't, like, that's not something you would just intuitively know, right? But just that one data point had me go, that's really interesting. So what did I do? I went to psychologytoday.com and started reading the website and, like, what were the recent articles? What were the most popular articles? And that already taught me, like, even just knowing that they read Psychology Today, that already taught me, like, oh, these are people who really care about their employees. They really want to understand other people. They want to understand what motivates them. They want to understand how to help people take better care of themselves. Then I got to thinking, like, huh, I wonder if HR managers just tend to be really empathetic people. Right? That just gives you so much to go off of. So I feel like just uncovering one thing that your audience consumes, whether it's a magazine, a website, a podcast, and just going deep on that one thing will tell you a lot about your customer.
Yeah, I think that's like a great example of a non-obvious insight too. Like, if you just went to your boss, back on my creativity rant, if you just went to your boss and you're like, let's put an ad in Psychology Today, like, that's obviously the most obvious application of that non-obvious insight. But they'd be like, why would we do that? We're not a psychology product. But like, you now know something that other people don't know, which is that RICP doesn't just read HR Manager Today, they read Psychology Today, right?
That'd be so, a super interesting publication though.
It's hilarious. So, MJ, I feel like when I was doing research, I found a couple things that you do really well. And whenever I see you sharing stuff on LinkedIn, I'm always thinking to myself, like, why didn't I think of that? Like, that's so good. So what is something that you're doing as it relates to research these days that, you know, maybe you don't give away everything about how you're using it, but what's something a little unconventional that you're doing?
Oh man, I almost never do anything unconventional. People always ask me, like, what questions should I ask my customers in research? And I can't answer that question. You know, that's like asking, you know, like, what question should I ask someone in a job interview? It's like, it depends on the role. Every time I do research, I design like a specific set of questions for that interview. But, you know, I think you can do a small amount of prep work and make your customer research interviews like so much more powerful. So I literally will open up a blank document every time I'm going to do a customer research call with someone, and I'll write down, who am I talking to? What do I want to learn from them? And how am I going to use that information? And like, usually I can actually do it backwards, right? So first, how am I going to use the information? Then what information do I need in order to be able to use it? And then like, who should I talk to in order to get that information? I think a lot of people just run customer research interviews and ask everybody the same questions, or don't actually think about how they're going to use the information ahead of time, so they don't ask questions that they should. Force yourself to write it down and like, be very specific, because you're going to ask very different questions if your purpose is to like, define new product features versus figure out the competitive positioning against a very specific, you know, substitute, right?
So obviously I love customer questions and surveys and stuff like that, so this is a good topic, but I think for us, the important thing is to get a colorful picture that's a mixture of both quantitative research that's broad-based across a larger user base, and then also much more colorful, rich, you know, individual interactions. I think on the individual interactions, I think you're right. It's like, you can tell the difference between like, when you do reference calls for, you know, a candidate, sometimes you have like box checking HR people that are like, how did you know the person? Did they do a good job? And then they're like, cool, I'm done. Great. And then you have these conversations, right, that, you know, follow a narrative arc, and you kind of ask the next logical question and flow, and you're able to get much deeper from that. I think the interesting thing is like, in the survey space, which is obviously designed to be, you know, broad-based, sweeping, quantitative. You know, if you think about where we've come in 25 years in the survey space, we've, you know, essentially gone from taking a survey on a clipboard and succeeded in putting it in a web browser window. And that's about the extent of the progress in 25 years. I think, you know, Typeform launched a really cool product recently that I've been thinking about for many years called Formless, which is basically if you take questions out of this arbitrary container, which is surveys, and put them into a conversation, which now you can do with more generative AI style Drift chatbot, you actually can accomplish that sort of scale that you would achieve with a survey with a much more conversational flow of questions that are then mapped against this conversational arc. So I think that is one of the, you know, the advances that we'll see in the coming years is we'll be able to capture more conversational style, richer insights, but still at the scale of a one-to-many approach like a survey. And that's something that we're really excited about.
I think one thing that's not talked about enough is like, how do you use the research? Especially when we're talking about, like,
this is the entire.
We
next
don't. It goes into a spreadsheet and it
into,
sits in a
so
Google
Drive. Take it away, MJ.
Okay, cool. But yeah, like especially when you're doing qualitative, just like recorded one-to-one customer interviews, I actually think it takes a very special type of person. And I think this is actually the key to finding a good product marketing manager is it to like pull out something that's actually a non-obvious insight and to be able to quickly filter through the things that are obvious insights and that are going to just like, you could probably make that assumption anyway versus the one thing that's like, ooh, that is something that we should build an entire marketing program around because nobody else knows that, right? I think, you know, 75% of product marketing managers will listen to a customer interview and they'll gloss over or skip over, right, the two real true nuggets of gold in that interview. So I think it's really important, like, how you distill the insights and then use them. It's like probably 80% of the battle, right? A lot of people just don't even do the research in the first place, but it's not like you can do bad research and then you can use good research poorly. So there's a lot of ways to fail at this, you know?
Like your Zoom thumbs up there. That's nice.
I know. Let me try.
So one of the things, and I forget where I came across this, it was, you know, moving from insights to action. And I think Amanda pointed this out when we were prepping for this, that marketers have a tendency, and I've been there plenty of times before, to, you know, get stuck in analysis paralysis and try to optimize for, you know, some laughable increase that's like 0.5%, and they're so focused on that. So how do you try to prioritize, you know, the big swings that you're trying to make from some of these insights and filter out the noise from the rest?
One of the things that I do is I'll take like a recorded call and I'll play it back and I make like a spreadsheet with three columns. So I'm looking for pain points, pain relievers, customer jobs to be done, right? And, you know, I might find all of those things in the call. I might find four of one and none of the other, right? But this is what I'm listening back to. And when I hear any of those things, a pain point, a pain reliever, or a job to be done, I put it in the spreadsheet. I summarize, like, what is it? What's the pain point? Who said it? And what exactly did they say when they were describing that pain point? And this actually spits out like a really nice, you know, maybe you end up with like 15 rows of data from each call. And if you dump like five calls in there, you're going to get 75 rows of data. And it's like a really quick, like I can look at this and then I can be like, all right, this is how I'm going to write the copy for this landing page. I'm going to see the three things that come up again and again. I'm going to highlight those. I'm going to drop the customer language and these pain points and pain relievers straight into the copy for the page. So that's one way that I've done a lot because I find that a lot of companies, especially if they are building marketing for the first time, which tends to be the place that I play in as a marketing leader, they don't have like use case specific pages on their website. They don't have like product specific or industry specific pages on their website. So like this is a great, really quick win application of customer research. And that's kind of exactly how you do it to make sure that it actually gets used.
So, Amanda, I'm going to out you. You said you don't like tests. What do you do here?
I don't really like marketing tests. I think they are, like, sometimes just kind of a waste of time. I think sooner or later, you have to just know how to do your job and make a decision and do the thing. Now, you know, I'm not saying never test things. Never
I didn't put those words in your mouth.
Well, because I've kind of ranted about this a couple times on social media. And of course, you know, some people come out of the woodwork to be like, well, you should test things. And I'm like, well, I mean, sure. But anyway, I'm just kind of like, So, I mean, the problem that I see with tests is that you kind of bog yourself down with doing test after test after test when you really should just make a decision and it'll help you move faster. Like, sometimes it's not about testing the landing page. Like, we got to A/B test this thing so that we know. Sometimes you should, but sometimes, like, it also depends on a lot of other factors, right? Like, if you're not getting a ton of traffic to a given landing page, then that means that if you're testing it, you're going to wait a long time to see statistically meaningful behavior, at which case you're going to be like, well, now we know 3 months later we have to change this element. When it's like, you could have just had it be different from the get-go, and then if it didn't work, then you could just change it again, which I know is in essence a test, but it's not some kind of formalized, like, structured, now we know exactly 0.01% of people did this thing. It's like, just make a decision, you know? And there are other things that you can test ongoing that don't really cost you anything. Like, a good example with this would be A/B testing an email subject line. Like, that's free, right? And by free, I mean you can test a newsletter campaign real time, right? You'll have your email provider, like, kind of test that, like, it goes out to, what, 15% of the list, and then it chooses a winner. Like, sure, like, why not do that? Like, that's harmless. It's not costing you time or energy, right? Like, it's just the time that it's costing is, like, an extra 20 minutes. That's fine.
I do think, though, you're totally right that people use testing as, like, a crutch to not be decisive. Like, I think a really simple litmus test of that is, like, are we doing this test because we don't feel like engaging in conflict to make a decision? Or are we doing this test because we're actually going to get an insight that we're going to use later, right?
Yeah, cool. That's so well said.
That's really well said.
Great point. That's a good insight. The testing to avoid conflict and making an opinionated decision. When I see, like, our engineering team talking about, like, UI and UX decisions, it's like, oh, we can't agree on it, so let's, you know, we'll see how it goes and just test it and see how it works. But yeah, I never thought about that before. It is a substitute for someone taking a stand, which is interesting.
So, story within a story, I think it was Amanda who mentioned A/B testing and whatnot. The light bulb moment for me was when Pep Laya founded Winter, because he came from, like, an experimentation space, and he flat out said that, I'm going to make the percentage up, but, like, something crazy, let's say 90%+ of companies just don't get enough traffic to have meaningful A/B tests. So what did he do? He went and founded a qualitative research company for the rest of the world. So, like, if the big companies are the only ones who can truly get meaningful statistical significance from these A/B tests, like, I'm not going to over-obsess over doing A/B tests.
You always get, like, when I got acquired by SurveyMonkey from our startup, we were towards that size of, like, 800 people where you start to get those, like, MBAs that worked at Bain or McKinsey, you know, and they drop in there and they're like, their theory and their strategy is, like, totally on point, and they'd have the most beautiful, like, decks and pivot tables and stuff like that, but it'd just be totally divorced from, like, the reality of, like, what was going on at the ground floor. So it's just, yeah, if you're Johnson & Johnson and you have a 10 million email list, like, sure, you can do some real quant stuff, but yeah, like, at the low level, that qualitative intuition driven, I think, is a, you know, a good guidepost for sure.
Yeah, those Bain and McKinsey consultants are probably the
same.
No
offense if anyone did MBA or went to Bain or McKinsey. Obviously, we know you're smart. We get it.
They're probably the same people doing those three-month listening tours, and then they come back and give you, like, hey, this is what we heard. It's like, I could have done that in a couple days.
Beautiful slide deck, though. Beautiful slide deck.
That's hilarious. Well, we are just about time here. This was awesome. I learned a whole lot about research in general, audience research, customer research. We will hopefully have to run it back with maybe the same group later down the line once we do a little bit more research on our research this year. But thank you for coming on to the Proof Point. This was fun.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Enjoyed it.